Boston Mayor Marty Walsh announced this afternoon that he's holding the city's reopening at Phase 2, Step 2 for 3 more weeks. Now, that is alongside a statewide infection rate above 8% and with only about 40% of the Commonwealth's vaccine doses administered. So are we prepared for a full vaccine rollout in the coming months? And do you know how to stay safe in the meantime? We are going to start today by taking your coronavirus and vaccine questions. The number to call is 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, joining us to take questions is Dr. Michael Collins, a Senior Vice President for Health Sciences for the University of Massachusetts System. He's also Chancellor of the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and Dr. Cassandra Pierre, an infectious disease physician and acting hospital epidemiologist at Boston Medical Center, also an assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Drs. Collins and Pierre, welcome.
Wonderful to be here.
Good afternoon.
Great to have you both. So Dr. Collins, I'm going to start with you because you recently co-authored an op-ed in The Globe with UMass President Marty Meehan advocating for essentially a vaccine corps, a national COVID-19 vaccine corps of college students to help with the rollout. What's the problem you're trying to solve with that recommendation?
Well, it's the reality yet to come, Tiziana, which is that once we have vaccinated healthcare workers and institutionalized populations, patients in nursing homes and et cetera, there's going to be a need to vaccinate the general population. And that's going to require person power like we haven't seen before. The ability for us to deliver vaccinations into the arms of, you know, literally hundreds of millions of people is going to take a core. And if you see some of the pictures on TV or listen to some of the stories on the radio, you recognize that in some places in the country where this has begun, it's been a bit challenging. In Massachusetts here, I think there's been a very thoughtful process of let's get the healthcare workers vaccinated first, and then we'll move into the nursing home population. We'll get to the general population in a bit. Take that thoughtful approach and now plan to do a much larger number of people. It seems to me we're going to need a core. Match that up with the fact that a number of students have decided to take gap years or are going to school virtually. And I've heard from many of them say, geez, I wish there was something that I could do to contribute. And this might be a way for folks to contribute. Not to mention that healthcare workers are quite tired, and to burden them with this responsibility may not be the best way to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible.
So just briefly, and then I want to turn to Dr. Pierre, it sounds like this with this kind of idea, college students are one type of available labor, but we also have 10 million unemployed Americans in the country right now. Could this be a short-term jobs program as well?
Yes, yes, and yes.
Excellent. Well, okay, so Dr. Pierre, I do want to turn to you. One of the things that Dr. Collins was just talking about was the need to scale up vaccination after we get through phase one. And you know, and he mentioned that there's been some criticism, although Massachusetts seems to be relatively well off, that the rollout is happening slowly. Are we on par with what you would expect here in the Commonwealth? And if not, why? Or if so, why do you think we're getting it right?
It's a great question. I think that it's easier for me to talk in the realm of my own experience, but I know other healthcare institutions are very similar in this approach. Many have been involved on multiple calls across multiple platforms, speaking to each other. This pandemic has really brought many healthcare institutions together, speaking the same language in the same meetings, trying to collaborate and partner rather than seeing each other's as competitors. And so there's a lot of conversation about how to center equity, how to think about vaccine allocation, and how to message and how to communicate, how to rely on our community partners, even while focusing first on the first wave of people to vaccinate, as you mentioned, the healthcare workers and those in long-term care facilities. And so I think that while we always wish we were further ahead than we are, I think that we have been in a really good position. We've been vaccinating a huge amount of healthcare workers. We have systems that have been set up to ensure, and we've been anticipating this for a number of months, so we've been setting up our systems for healthcare workers, doing education, understanding that not only is it important to vaccinate our healthcare workers for their own safety, for the safety of the community and for our patients, but because they also will serve as unofficial ambassadors to our patients and show that we value this so much, we believe in this so much, that we are willing to all get this done to protect ourselves. So I think that we're in a good position, but I've noticed in the past few days that the numbers have started to trail off, whether it be because of vaccine supply or because individuals are we've started to reach a wave of individuals who may not be as comfortable taking the vaccine.
So we have opened the phones, and I'm going to turn to them. We'll have calls on both the vaccine, but also just on the coronavirus in general. And I think I'll start with a couple of questions there. 800-423-8255. We've got Dave on the line from West Roxbury. Dave, go ahead. What's your question?
Hi, guys. Well, first of all, on the vaccination, just real quick, I don't think we were prepared enough. I mean, why aren't we mass vaccinating people over 75 right now? Why is it that we haven't really even started? It's been 3 or 4 weeks now. I know the holidays were in the way, but we should be vaccinated at night, during the weekends, all the 24 hours we should be vaccinating the people most at risk. And then once that happens and death starts trailing off, then things will look a lot better. But until we do that, and anyways, we just didn't seem prepared for it. What I really wanted to say was, Marty now is such a city down again for 3 more weeks because the first 3 weeks didn't work either. We seem to be doubling down on the message that doesn't seem to be resonating with a lot of people. And I think they need to change the way they're doing things. One of the problems is there's nothing for people to do. Everything is closed. And because of that, they're getting together with their family and friends. And maybe, you know, the Museum of Fine Arts was a super spreader. I mean, if they allow
Dave, let me take it back.
Things,
yeah, thank you, Dave. I appreciate it. And 2 points there. I'm going to start with the first one, Dr. Collins, on vaccination. Now, just to Dave's point, Governor Charlie Baker did move people over the age 75 and older up in the vaccine prioritization yesterday. So they are still not phase one, but they are moved up in phase two. So just to clarify that, but are you feeling like we've got our priorities straight and are rolling out where we need to in a targeted way, Dr. Collins?
Well, I think that the priorities are very well established. The group that the governor put together to think through how you know, what groups would be organized and when. I think that's all been very, very thoughtfully considered. I think that everyone is going to, you know, want this to be done yesterday. So I think I can appreciate the frustration of wanting to get vaccinations into more arms as quickly as possible. We have to recognize that the supply is limited. It's a big country. States have been allocated certain amounts of vaccine, and they're working now to work through those vaccines into people's arms. I think the bigger challenge, to Dave's point, is that when we get to the general population, there's going to be hundreds of millions of people, and we're clearly going to need systems that can accommodate that that increased need.
And Dr. Collins, have you gotten any response from the state to yours and Marty Meehan's proposal for this vaccine corps?
We're in some conversations with them. And we have a bit of a pilot already working with one of our entities at the medical school. And the question is whether we can expand on that. And we're going to be having conversations very shortly with them about that.
So, Dr. Pierre, let's turn then to the other part of Dave's question, which was, if I'm reading him correctly, frustration that we are shutting down formal venues for another 3 weeks in the city of Boston, at least, when the spread, to the best that our data tells us, when the spread is coming from private gatherings. What is your reaction to that overall? And do we need some kind of other message?
Yeah, I know. I think it's definitely an excellent point. We know that there's a lot of household indoor gathering spread. A lot of that spread prior to the rollback was happening in establishments. You know, there were lots of outbreaks in restaurants and other indoor venues and businesses. Although I agree with him, it may be not the ones that have been rolled back. I think it's important to send a message, and the city has tried to do that with trying to limit the amount of people who are at indoor gatherings. But, you know, we continue to see people at indoor gatherings. I continue to see things that really surprise me, a party bus rolling down the highway. And so I think that, to his point, I think that perhaps there does need to be a little bit of messaging about what some alternatives might be. A few months ago, many people were advocating for the city to set up some kind of winter activities that encourage social distancing, or basically something else to take people's minds off of feeling cooped up. I think that, you know, it's certainly something to be investigated, but I also think that some of those venues that even seem to be lesser risk are also places where you may be unnecessarily venturing out to have spread, given the higher level of asymptomatic infection in the community. So even those places that we previously viewed as benign may pose unnecessary risk for exposure, infection, and disease.
Before I go back to the phones, and I will, 800-423-8255 is the number to call with your coronavirus or vaccine questions. There have been some discussions about vaccine supplies, and I want to ask the two of you kind of a compound question. We have right now more doses on hand than we are able to distribute. We know that because we know that roughly 40% of the Commonwealth's current supply has been distributed. We also know that there are some questions being floated and some research being done about, for example, delivering a half dose of the Moderna vaccine instead of a full dose, giving more people single doses and delaying on giving a second dose in order to roll it out more quickly. Is that the rate limiting factor? Is it that we need to reduce the dosage to get more out to people, or do we have some cogs in the distribution system that if we can get fixed, we can give the vaccine as originally intended and not either have a surplus or have to sort of scrimp? Does my question make sense?
It does. I would be very cautious about changing the manner in which we distribute the vaccine. The studies have been done on two dose administrations of the vaccine. We are trying to get folks to be confident that the vaccines are safe and effective. And now would not, in my opinion, now would not be the time to be the change, the route of administration or the practice of doing vaccine administration. What we need to do is produce vaccine and distribute vaccine. Now, I think the good news to the point that the caller raised, the way I'm looking at it is, it's not like it was last March. It's this January. So I think we have to look at the future and say, if we just can get through another month or two, get large numbers of people vaccinated, then we'll be in a position where we can start to approach some more normalcy. And so it's not like it was at the beginning of this. We're sort of at the end of it. And I'm quite hopeful about that future. But now is not the time to, I think we have to stick by our leaders who are saying, look, it's just, while the environment of a museum may be fine, you've got to get to the museum, you've got to get back from the museum, maybe you choose to have something to eat while you're out. None of those venues are very safe. Well, it might be fine around the museum. It's the going and the coming that's some of the issues. So I can clearly understand why folks are suggesting we not be out and about. Not to mention that we're starting to approach large capacity, you know, full hospitals. And over the next few weeks, those are likely to get even more full. So we've got to get ourselves to a position where we're on the other side of this. And we're clearly not there yet, which is why folks are saying a short time more, and then we can get back to some sense of normalcy.
And to your point, I do want to note that the last time we had Boston Mayor Marty Walsh on the air just before Christmas, he also argued it's not that the spread is unique to these types of venues, but when the concentrations in the community are this high, you do right. Whatever you can to limit exposure. So Dr. Sure. Pierre, we you know, to Dr. Collins's point, we need to get through the next few months until we reach high levels of vaccination. I saw some new reporting this week about a Boston study that's looking into the effects of vitamin D on severity of COVID-19 symptoms. And that's something we've had calls on in the past. So what do we know about the impact of something like vitamin D and other treatments that could or might, or that we are investigating whether they will reduce the severity of the illness until people can get vaccinated?
So it's not going to be a magic bullet. Vitamin D has been studied for both decreasing the severity of COVID-19 disease as well as has been looked at extensively in prevention as well. Prevention of COVID-19, there is some data to show that vitamin D supplementation might decrease the risk of having COVID-19. But I would just caution people, although, you know, people are looking at this, vitamin D has been proposed as a medication that might prevent and lessen severity for numerous types of infections based on its association with immune cell production. It is not something that is going to be most likely the difference between, from what we can tell, between you staying at home with COVID and going to the hospital or potentially even being intubated. So there's definitely more information to come. But from the data that we have, using our infection prevention techniques, the mask, the physical distancing, washing hands, the things that we're so sick of saying, and then on top of that, getting vaccinated, really are the best ways for us to stay safe. So I certainly don't want to discourage people from taking vitamin D, from doing the things that are safe and potentially protective. But I also want us to understand that we actually do have data that the vaccine is safe and effective. And if we can do the things that we need to do to reduce our exposure to infection before we are eligible to get it, then that will be so much more worth it.
So let's go back to the phones. We've got Nicole on the line from Worcester. Nicole, what's your question?
So hospitals and nursing homes, they have a big organization and a plan in place for vaccinating their staff and their patients. But what about for healthcare workers that are not a part of a giant organization like that, private practice people, therapists, chiropractors, things like that?
Okay, thanks for that question, Nicole. I'm going to grab one more question, then we'll go back to both doctors. We've got James on the line from Woburn. James, go ahead.
Hello, Vice President of UMass. I actually go to one of the UMass campuses. I am a neurodivergent individual who suffers from schizophrenic delusions in life, and I cannot take this vaccine because it will destroy my mental health. I have many delusions about this vaccine, and I'm very afraid. So, as the Vice President, how will you take care of those suffering from mental illness and those who are neurodivergent at the UMass system? Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for your call, James. Dr. Collins, do you want to address James's question first?
Well, it's obviously a challenging question. I don't like to practice medicine on an interview, so I think it wouldn't be appropriate for me, not really understanding fully his own medical situation, to comment on that. I will say that there may be some very limited reasons why folks don't take the vaccine. But remember that if we can get a combination of 80% of the population, 70 or 80% of the population who have either had the disease or get the vaccine, that will get us to what is called herd immunity. And that will help us to end the pandemic. And that needs to be our goal. There are very, very large number of mental health services available within the University of Massachusetts system. And I'm sure that the caller could access those if appropriate.
Thanks for that, Dr. Collins. And Dr. Pierre, the question about those who are in, let's say, private practice or home-based healthcare workers, I will say that I'm looking at the phases chart right now, and home-based healthcare workers and healthcare workers doing non-COVID-facing care are in the bottom of phase one. So they are targeted, but I think Nicole was asking about a plan as well. Are you aware of the plan for distribution to non-hospital-based healthcare workers?
In a limited fashion, and this question really spoke to me because my mother is a podiatrist in Arizona who is in private practice. So we've been trying to troubleshoot where she can get her vaccine because she meets a number of criteria, including being a medical health professional. But the state has recently discussed or announced the opening of 62 mass vaccination sites in Massachusetts for first responders, which presumably would also include those who are not don't have responsibility taken up by their own proprietary healthcare institutions. I would also say the medical associations that people are affiliated with within Massachusetts might be the first place to turn to. That's what we did for my mother, to figure out where they might go to partner with a healthcare facility that may have some additional doses that they can provide for that healthcare provider. But I believe that there are probably a number of mechanisms and the proprietary medical association might be able to help. So Mass Medical Association in our case, but potentially if not, then one of those mass vaccination sites for frontline workers that will be that have been announced.
All right, that is very helpful. And we are at the end of our time. Dr. Cassandra Pierre is an infectious disease physician and acting hospital epidemiologist at Boston Medical Center. And Dr. Michael Collins is chancellor of the University of Massachusetts Medical School. You were both generous with your time and your guidance today. Thanks to both of you.
Nice to be with
you. Wonderful to be here.
So as we discussed before the break, we have reached the vaccination stage of the pandemic finally, but for a lot of workers who have to be on the job site every day, their shot in the arm won't come for weeks, possibly months, while the virus could be just around the corner. And that is certainly true for construction workers. With that in mind, last month, a group of trade union leaders, construction executives, international health experts from Boston teamed up to form the Construction Stops COVID initiative. Their goal is using targeted testing, tracing, and treatment to help keep tens of thousands of hard hats safe across the city. Frank Callahan is president of the Massachusetts Building Trades Council and has been part of the effort. Joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to Radio Boston, Frank.
Thank you for having me today, Tiziana.
So, Frank, put us in the day in the life of a construction worker on a Boston job site right now. What are the risks for that worker throughout the day when it comes to this pandemic?
Well, the risks are largely the same as we see in the larger population. But obviously, in the construction industry, you're working in close proximity in some cases. You might be working in a trench. You might be working in an enclosed space. And that's very difficult. You know, you're lifting heavy objects, working on tools and equipment that require more than one individual. So it is difficult. We do make sure that our members in the union side sector have the proper PPE, whether it's masks, gloves, face shields, and hand washing stations and the like, to make sure that they're as safe as possible out there. But it is still a risky place to be.
And you just talked about those provisions for safety, Frank. Are there particular challenges for the industry, for construction companies, in providing the safety equipment, in meeting the standards that the Commonwealth has set for that industry?
Well, we didn't face that in the union side sector. We're fortunate. You know, we represent 75,000 men and women who work in the construction industry all across the state. And we have longstanding relationships with our contractor community, with over 3,000 union contractors. And that's a partnership, whether it's through training, healthcare, pensions, wages, of course, and putting up all the buildings and infrastructure that you see every day. So we were able to work in a cooperative manner with them, as we do on a regular basis prior to the pandemic. So I'm proud of the fact that our union leadership, our contractor associations, and the contractors themselves were able to step up and do what was necessary from the very early stages of this to make sure that our members were protected out there.
So help us understand, Frank, where are the pain points for your union members, for the industry, in trying to function? I understand, I think it was May 18th, at the beginning of the phase one reopening, that at least parts of the construction industry were able to reopen. So where have those pain points been? What do people need to understand?
Well, if you can go back even before that, Governor Baker issued his order in March on shutdowns and safety protocols when we had far less knowledge of what was going on out there. And the weak spots we saw in that was it was left the construction industry largely open with a hodgepodge of protocols, where the enforcement was largely left to the cities and towns, and many of whom did not have the resources to enforce that. And what we saw was that a lot of contractors, not on our side, on the union sector, but a lot of them were not enforcing those protocols, just what has become the defining aspect of this pandemic, the mask. There were many construction sites you could drive by and not see a single individual wearing even a mask. So where that comes into play for our members, and certainly for those workers who are not represented by a union, but our members sometimes work on job sites where there's a mix of union and non-union workers. So whether it was pandemic or other safety protocols, that left our members at risk, and certainly those non-represented workers at risk. So we were happy to see, which sounds strange coming from a person in my position, when Boston Mayor Marty Walsh shut down non-essential construction in the city of Boston. I mean, that's anathema to everything I've done in my career in this. We're always seeking mm-hmm. more work opportunities for our members, but we take safety first. safety is first and foremost in our minds every single day prior to, during, and after this pandemic. And we thought he did the right thing. In fact, shortly after he did that, a number of cities and towns followed suit. And we took this unusual step, the only one in the country, where the building trades in Massachusetts took a unanimous vote to shut down the construction industry for 2 weeks. We called on the governor to do that because there's a lot of legal requirements, and we wanted to make sure there was full compliance. And, of course, that didn't happen because, again, we wanted to have to flatten the curve like everyone else, and we wanted to make sure that our contractors and our members had the opportunity to come up to speed, whether it's, you know, PPE, hand washing stations, sufficient, you know, porta potties, and so forth.
So have you had a back and forth with the Commonwealth? Have you, has your union been in conversation with the governor or the governor's office or the planning? What has that been like?
No, we have not. We have not had any communication from the governor's office, which led us to the conclusion that we had to take matters into our own hands, which was the result, as you talked about earlier, the Construction Stops COVID campaign, the program that was put together largely with the work of the Greater Boston Building Trades Unions, led by Brian Daugherty, our contractor associations with some of the large names you see, whether it's Suffolk, Turner, Moriarty and Associates, and of course, partners in health and Harbor Health Services. We realized if we didn't take charge of this ourselves, it wasn't going to happen.
And so what will be different? I know that the initiative began on December 22nd, so I guess I should say, what is different now with this initiative in place?
Well, at its very basis, it's tracking, testing, and tracing, and then followed by treatment. Because one of the things that was left out by the governor's recommendations was tracking in the workplace. There is nowhere in any of the initiatives put forward by the Baker-Polito administration that require the listing of a workplace. So if there is an outbreak at a workplace, whether it's a construction site or like the couple of Walmarts we saw early on, they'll take sometimes weeks to find out that there's an outbreak at those workplaces. That doesn't do any good for the workers that are on those job sites or the general public that's shopping in those stores. So we felt that was the most important piece. We see it and we hear it, and a lot of it's anecdotal because we do not have the data to show that there may be an outbreak on a job site.
So are you collaborating with the state's contact tracing organization or Partners in Health on the contact tracing that you're doing here?
With Partners in Health, and of course that would be transmitted to the state after the fact, but we're doing that on our own to make sure that, you know, if there is an outbreak, that we can track that and trace that to a job site and make sure that those members have the information they need to protect themselves and their families.
And Frank, if somebody in the construction trades wanted to know more about this initiative or how they can benefit from it, where can they go to learn more?
It's constructionstopscovid.org.
All right. And I'm sure we can put a link to that to our website as well. That's Frank Callahan, president of Massachusetts Building Trades Council. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
We are going to spend the rest of the hour talking about our mental health. This is a time of year when many hit a wall. We know that depression and anxiety have been up as much as threefold since the start of the pandemic. We know the holidays, while restful and healing for some, can be also isolating and heartbreaking for some. And we know that we've got long months of darkness and winter remaining ahead of us. So how are you feeling right now? How are you doing? Are you or someone you love struggling with feeling isolated or anxious or overwhelmed by the moment? Or maybe you have strategies that are helping you or people that you know avoid the wall, and you want to share that. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. We have two therapists joining us now for this conversation. Omar Ruiz is a marriage and family therapist and the owner of Talk, Think, Thrive Counseling Services in Wellesley. And Claire Willis is a clinical social worker and the co-founder of the Boston nonprofit Facing Cancer Together. She also regularly leads bereavement and support groups. And her new book with co-author Maureen Crawford Samuelson is called Opening to Grief, Finding Your Way from Loss to Peace. They've both been on the show over the last several months. Omar, Claire, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So, Omar, how are you? Have you confronted a wall at any point? Are you worried about that, or are you hanging in there during this?
I would say when everything first started, me personally, I had confronted a wall. It was more of around just the basic human nature of needing to survive, like your food, shelter, and then making sure that we're safe. And then as time went on and there were certain safety measures that were put into place, then I felt a bit more relief. And I started also noticing that from a lot of the clients that I would see. As of right now, today, I'm actually doing great because I'm holding on to hope that things are changing.
I'm glad to hear that. Claire, I guess I want to ask you the same question.
You know, it's funny. When this first struck, the publisher of our book said, we need a manuscript immediately. And I think my necessity to focus on the manuscript kept me off of a lot of feelings about it. And one of the things that's been really helpful is just to be talking about grief and all the tendrils of grief that this COVID has brought to different people. It just affected every impact of our life, every aspect of our life. And so I think being a part of trying to work with this and connect with people has really helped keep me off of it. Having said that, I would say, it's funny that you're asking. Yesterday morning, I woke up and I thought, oh my gosh, the holidays are over and we're looking at 2 to 3 months. And something hit me yesterday. I feel much better today, but I noticed that I really hit a wall yesterday morning.
Thank you for sharing that, Claire. I think for our listeners, it's helpful to know, you know, if this is a tough time, you know, you're not alone in that. Our phone number to call is 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I am going to say this now, and I'll do this once more before the end of the show. I also want to give our listeners some other resources if you need them. So if you have a pen and paper and you're feeling need for immediate help, you can reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-TALK. That's 800-273-8255. And the Samaritans statewide hotline, you can call or text it at 1-877-870-HOPE or 870-4673. Omar, is this a time of year that even not during a pandemic can be challenging for people with mental health?
Certainly. During this time of year, there's a heightened what is called seasonal affective disorder. It's normally just a version of depression because of the changes in time, as well as the sunrise and sunset. And so just on a regular basis, I would see clients, specifically couples, who are dealing with changes in their communication, and that a lot of it tends to be affected by the depression that they're experiencing due to the changes. And when you combine COVID and this pandemic, it just doubles in nature in terms of depression and anxiety symptoms.
And Claire, the holidays are just in our rearview mirror. What do we know about the relationship between this holiday season, the holiday season, and people's anxiety, depression, loneliness, isolation, et cetera?
You know, I think it's multifaceted. I mean, I have a lot of clients who say that the holidays were quite depressing because of the changes that were required. On the other hand, it gave people structure. It gave people a focus for their life between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And I think now might begin to be a little bit harder time over the next few weeks until the vaccination arrives and until there's more light and until we can begin to connect, because we've really lost the resources that we normally have for holding grief and for holding a seasonal affective disorder. You know, we can't connect with each other in the ways we used to, and certainly we've lost touch and holding. And those are very comforting things when you're struggling with depression or seasonal affective disorder.
So Omar and Claire, let's go to the phones. 800-423-8255 is the number to join this conversation on mental health. We've got Amy on the line from Lowell. Amy, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to speak as a parent and just say that connecting with nature and being outdoors is an essential life skill. You know, and it'll serve children well either after the pandemic. So now more than ever, parents just really need to limit screen time. Our kids are on the screen all day with school, so limiting you know, screen time for entertainment is paramount. And kids have just got to put on jackets and put on boots, and they've got to go outside, and they've got to play, they've got to run, and they need fresh air more than ever. And that's a skill that's going to help them with their mental health their whole life if they learn it now.
Thanks for that call, Amy. Let's add Lisa, too. Lisa's in Maynard. Lisa, go ahead.
I'd like to echo, actually Amy's sentiment. Like, for myself, personally, as an adult, like, getting outside, whether it's, you know, winter weather or spring, summer, has, like, helped me through this pandemic tremendously. Like, outdoor exercise, skiing, hiking, walking, and you don't have to be an expert at, like, really any of those things, but to get out in nature is so soothing for your soul, and it can really, really cure, you know, mental health of any kind, regardless of being in a pandemic. And my nephew, probably to echo any sentiment, is just one of my nephews is like the happiest kid despite like all that's going on, because my sister does like make an attempt to get him outside, and he loves, you know, making snowmen and going for bike rides. Mm-hmm. So it is important, I think, for adults and kids. Like, nature is literally like such a soothing force, and it's so, a lot of times free. So
that's a good point, Lisa. So, Omar, what do we know? I mean, there's testimonials from two callers saying this is such an important part of well-being, is being able to be outside, be in nature. What do we know about that from the research, from, you know, therapeutic approaches and strategies?
Yeah, so there's, I'm not an expert around this, but there is a notion of light therapy. And so light therapy is essentially scheduling time to take in some natural sources of light so that you can increase the vitamin D that you're getting from the sun, as well as trying to balance your circadian rhythm because of the fact that the changes in time zones and the changes in sunrise and sunset has an immediate effect on people. That's why a lot of people, when there's the changes in more sunlight, people are more wanting to go outdoors. And especially that we live in New England, we tend to have to stay inside because even though we want to be outside, it tends to get very cold and we might get a nor'easter.
So Claire, yeah, the nor'easter was on my mind too, Omar. Claire, I'm going to let you build on Omar, but I'm going to give you an additional question to answer in that, which is, in listening to Lisa and Amy, of course, I'm also thinking social distancing. Kids are, you know, they're asking us not to be together outside our own household. And in skiing, you would need to be, you know, away from other people and not gathering in indoor businesses at too high concentrations, et cetera. So where does the social distancing pressure fit into whether being out in nature is enhancing our well-being?
I want to respond to the first two callers, Amy and Lisa, because there's a lot of research, specifically there's some research by the Kaplans about restorative environments. And when people have been on the screens all day and their eyes are focused, and I'm thinking a lot about children, when you go outside, one of the things about nature that's so restorative is that the eyes rest. There's a way in which the outside comes to you. You're not focusing on that. And that's why after we go outside and we return to work or a project or to a computer, we feel restored. So there's a lot of research about restorative environments. So what people are feeling is really has some very strong backing. There's so much we can do outside there's so much we can do outside at a social distance that keeps us both safe and comfortable and connected. One of the things I learned from my daughter who lived in Germany is that the Germans have the idea, and I think this is pretty prevalent in Europe, is that there's no such thing as bad weather. There's just not being properly dressed for what is outside. So I would say spending some money on warm clothes, if you have that privilege to do that, get outside as much as you can.
You know, I was thinking, Omar, Beth Tytel is a columnist in the Boston Globe and a friend of the show, and she had a piece in the Globe today about how the pandemic has kind of depleted our emotional reserves, and small things are finally the last straw. At one point, she writes, quote, "Anxiety, panic, and grief have turned us into a nation of cranky toddlers just waiting to blow." And I think we all either have or know someone who's just reached that moment where that last thing happened. And sometimes it's something small, like I can't get what I need from the grocery store, or it's big, like I just lost my job on top of everything else. How do you fight that moment, Omar, when it's just too much?
I would say a lot of it, at least from my experience, specifically when I'm working with couples and families, a lot of it's broken down into the connection that you have with loved ones as well as significant others. It's the breakdown of the communication. When you as an individual are struggling with just the feeling of isolation and being overwhelmed, and a pattern tends to develop, there's a need to feel connected as a way to gain hope. And when people start losing hope, that's when you start seeing severe mental health issues such as suicidal thoughts and actions. And so one of the things that I would highly suggest for people is to connect with those who provide you some sense of value, even if it means if we have no choice but to connect with them virtually or through FaceTime, as well as going with the notion of going outside, staying with a routine of healthy best practices, such as the food that we eat, creating a certain sleep pattern, disconnecting from online so that we can reconnect with our loved ones. And the last is incorporate a healthy and an achievable exercise routine.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Ingrid on the line in Roslindale. Ingrid, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to point out that I thought all those ideas about nature are great, but in the city of Boston, not everybody has that access where their kids can just run outside and go skiing and bicycling. And a lot of people living in, like, say, three-family houses can't do that. So it would be really nice if the city were able to do something to help those kids, you know, and adults as well.
Thanks for that call, Ingrid. I'm going to add on one other with you. Elisa is on the line from West Roxbury. Elisa, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I just had a similar concern about different activities and just access that people have to them. What are some things that people can do for their mental health that, you know, may not be in the privileged position to get out into nature or to do skiing or other activities?
Thanks for that, Elisa. So we've got two callers, Claire and Omar, saying, hey, access to nature, whether from a social justice perspective, shouldn't be, but can be and often is a privilege. And what are other strategies? Both, it's a call, I think, from Ingrid for us to address that social justice issue, but also what are other strategies people can use for themselves, their kids, when that kind of access to nature isn't available? Claire, a thought on that?
The first thought that comes to my mind, and it may sound kind of paradoxical, but I know some of my grandchildren have done this, is that at the end of the day, to have the family and the children write down three good things that happened that day. There's a lot of research about the benefits, psychological benefits of keeping a gratitude journal, because as much as there is wrong, there are some things that are right. And when we can redirect our attention towards what's right, we build our capacity to hold suffering, and we build our resilience. And there's a lot of research about that. So that's the first thing that came to my mind.
And Claire, sorry about that. I think we might have just had a caller voice kind of come in through there for a second. I do want to go back and grab another call. I think we'll go to Ashley in Salem. Ashley, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just want to talk about the conversation around the connection between the pandemic and trauma. We know that when someone has experienced a traumatic event, they are often left with this heightened sense of awareness and paranoia. And I feel that on a daily basis, no matter what I do, there is this ever-looming threat to anything I do. And I just wanted to ask you about that.
It's a great question. And Omar, I'll turn that to you. And we noticed in preparing for today that Vox actually did an analysis that found that the incidence of depressive or anxious symptoms among Americans almost exactly mirrors the rate of infection and the level of infection of the coronavirus in the United States. So there's some data there to what Ashley's saying.
What I would say is, to quickly point out for the other two callers in terms of like very concrete things of what folks can do if they don't have the privilege to be able to go outside, is one, try to do something that you can do indoors that normally you can take advantage outdoors, such as an indoor gardening. Second is invest times in doing family activities such as puzzles and board games, because if there's a lot of concerns around the amount of screen time that people are taking in, then try to go and do old school activities such as board games or puzzles. And then the last one is to join virtual clubs that allow for such physical activity, such as there are certain local gyms that even though they're currently closed in Boston, they allow for online workout routines. And to incorporate more light, you can easily undo your blinds and open up less shade in the household. So that's just some things. And also just create a different an environment within your household, such as like scents. I've worked with certain providers in collaboration with the couples that I work with just to create scents. Like there's this collaborator called Mimi Scented Candles that they could provide certain scents to help you change your environment. And so to go back quickly on the trauma piece, trauma has affected many different people's lives across this nation as well as within the city of Boston. I would say the number one advice I can give is to reach out to a healthcare provider. They are providing teletherapy or what is called telehealth. To be able to get support. And for those who haven't seen their doctors, try to schedule your annual physical, even if you can't physically or you're uncomfortable physically going to your local clinic or hospital, to try to set up an appointment with your doctor so that way you can assess whether or not you need support or if you're experiencing symptoms of depression or anxiety or changes in mood, that could be addressed by a professional.
So we won't have time to go back to the phones, but Claire, we did have a couple of callers, Mary and Deanna, who both wanted to say this is a time that has both forced us and given us an opportunity to use the phone, to use Zoom, to connect with people we love that we might not otherwise. And also saying, you know, when we do have that moment when we hit the wall, we need to be forgiving of ourselves. And I know that's something that you've thought about and talked about in the past. Maybe you can wrap us up there, Claire.
I just want to say a couple of things. One of the things is that a lot of the grief we feel for what we've lost is love that has nowhere to go. We grieve what we've lost and loved. And I think that's a way to frame it and to allow grief to have a fuller expression. This isn't going to change too quickly in the foreseeable future. So I think some of these techniques that Omar was talking about, and the one thing I would add to it is you might using journaling, because there's a lot of research about writing about feelings and not keeping them inside that's important in terms of stressing our bodies by inhibiting how we feel. And so that's just another resource I would urge people to think about during this difficult time.
Well, you've both been so helpful. Claire Willis is a clinical social worker and the co-founder of the Boston nonprofit Facing Cancer Together. She's co-author with Maureen Crawford Samuelson of the book Opening to Grief, Finding Your Way from Loss to Peace. And Omar Ruiz is a marriage and family therapist and the owner of Talk, Think, Thrive Counseling Services in Wellesley. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
And just one more time, listeners, you can reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 and the Samaritans statewide hotline, call or text at 877-870-4673 if you're feeling like you need some help right now.